Hello and welcome to the Future Building Podcast. I'm Matthew Aitchison and I'm Professor at Monash University and CEO of Building 4.0 CRC, a cooperative R&D hub for the building industry. Since launching the podcast back in 2020, we've brought you the best and brightest from the global building industry. We've tried to get a feel for where we might be headed and who might be likely to take us there. In the main, this took the shape of interviews with industry experts, entrepreneurs, researchers, investors, and commentators. In these interviews, I've tried to keep my own opinions to a minimum and focus on the brilliant guests sitting opposite me. I'm excited to say that we're launching a new stream of content, which I'm calling Essays. Essays are an opportunity to talk about ideas and opinions, to provide commentary and analysis on key issues, to explore the history and theory of building. And it's also an opportunity to provide journalism that I think is missing from the mainstream, and also to engage in some future casting. I hope you enjoy them and find them helpful. I should point out that all opinions are my own and do not represent those of Monash University or Building 4.0 CRC. And as ever, Future Building Podcast is proudly sponsored by Building 4.0 CRC. The Big Factory Idea, a cautionary tale. About a year ago, I was at a party when I was introduced to a local leader who ran an advocacy body in the city I was visiting. After hearing I work in housing innovation, he ventured, "All this talk about housing, I've got the solution." Okay, I thought, I'm curious. The government need to invest $500 million in a big factory which can pump out thousands of houses and finally solve this issue once and for all, he said. Now, I'm no expert, he qualified, but what am I missing? Why wouldn't that work? Before I go into what I answered that night and what I've been answering to similar questions for years, I want to mark this moment. This is, in its most naked form, what I've come to term the big factory idea. I feel like it needs a name because it's not just my non-expert colleague who has put forward such ideas. Over the past year, stocks in the big factory idea have risen. Its currency in government and industry circles has grown. The arguments and pitches currently in circulation promoting the big factory idea might be wrapped in more technical or financial sounding language than my party conversation, but underneath the slide decks, the graphs, the testimonials, lurks that same simple, compelling idea. If we just make a really big motor, we can go really, really fast. We've all heard by now there's a housing supply crisis around the world. And it's increasingly common to hear that government and industry are on the hunt for ways to solve the problem. Enter the big factory. If my feeling is correct, there is currently a growing global receptivity among private and public groups for big factory solutions. I'm aware of such propositions in Europe, North America, and Australia. Although I should confess some confirmation bias here, because these are the places that I actually tend to spend most of my time. But in these countries, plans are being drawn up, investment pitches are being cast, and meetings are being held. I'm recording this week from San Francisco, a city, dare say, a region, that has given rise to more than one big factory in its day, and a place that is renowned for aiming high. It seems fitting for the topic we're going to talk about this week. In this essay, I want to interrogate the big factory idea, to try to look at it from all sides. Is it a great idea that will solve the housing crises around the world, as my colleague hopes? What do we need to be mindful of when considering this idea? And finally, is the big factory idea the only solution, or can it coexist with other alternatives? Before we get into the interrogation proper, some observations on the manner in which the big factory idea is currently circulating. Expectedly, and given the supply crisis we are in, discussions around the big factory idea are very immediate and urgent. They tend to be focused on the present, which can lead proponents to forget that this has actually been tried before. Similarly, the urgency and scale of the problem apparently gives some license to airbrush not only over historical precedent, but other facts and figures that might describe key limiting conditions that underpin the housing markets into which they seek to enter. This kind of discussion is not helpful. Due diligence of any large venture would dictate just some of the following questions. Has this idea ever worked elsewhere? What have been the experiences of other ventures who've tried such approaches? Is there a market for the kinds of products being offered? Is there a pipeline of orders that would support such a factory? How will risks be managed? And where is the evidence to support such large investment, especially from public pockets, but also from private companies? As someone who believes in my inner fiber in the role of building innovation, I have to be both careful and clear in stating I'm never against innovation and I'm not against trying new things, especially around things so as important as housing. On the contrary, I would argue that the big factory idea, in the form I've heard it discussed, is not a new idea at all. In fact, it has a very long, long history. In 1984, Gilbert Herbert, historian of what I would term the heroic period of prefabrication, wrote of the Henry Ford syndrome, whose sufferers, he summarized, were plagued by the following belief: why can't we mass produce houses, standard, well designed, at low cost, in the same way Ford mass produces cars? The big factory idea is a close relative of the Henry Ford syndrome, even if it may not be immediately apparent. And this is important because, as Herbert pointed out, the Henry Ford syndrome has led so many ventures astray, many of whom who have failed to understand the fundamental differences between manufacturing houses and cars, something I too have written about in an article from 2017 entitled "A House Is Not a Car Yet." This is the lack of historical perspective I spoke of earlier. Similarly, if we take a more sober view of the facts and figures that describe the track record of the big factory, we also can't ignore the trail leading to the graveyard of broken big factory dreams. My colleague, Darrell Patterson, has done an analysis of 12 companies from around the world over the last 8 years. All proposed and built versions of the big factory. All collectively have burned around $4 billion in funding, and most of which have all collapsed. The biggest and most well-known of these was, of course, Katerra, whose big factory was only about an hour's drive from where I'm currently sitting, and who burned at least around $2 billion of that sum alone, without much to show for it, it must be said. But we should also point out that this is not a US phenomenon alone. Both the UK and Australia display similar, though more modest, losses. If I've managed to plant the seeds of doubt in the big factory idea based on these preliminary facts, hold that thought in the balance and consider the other selling points the big factory offers. After all, it would not have so many advocates around the world if it made absolutely no sense at all. Some benefits might include: it's highly visible. In a housing crisis where policy change can be invisible, the big factory is a shining beacon that everyone can see and point to. Governments, investors, and industry are all seen to be doing something. It's fast. In a context where turning a production system around to massively increase housing production or fine-tuning housing policy might take 5 to 10 years, building a big new factory in a year or two is relatively fast. Also, it's simple. The big factory idea is also so appealing because, for all involved, it takes a really complex problem with multiple parameters and contingencies and turns them into a simple proposition. Investment X offers a turnkey solution that can produce Y houses, no more wrangling or cajoling, No more wheeling or dealing, just a simple transaction. And finally, it sounds plausible. After all, the housing supply shortfall is a really big global problem. So don't we need to think big? Wouldn't it only stand to reason that the only really big solution will solve the problem, just like in other industries, right? In a global housing supply environment characterized by scarcity, and in an industrial sector as sclerotic as building, we need to acknowledge that it's reasonable to have big factory dreams, like a thirsty traveler in a desert might imagine lying in a cool spring. I get the frustration of all involved with the status quo. I feel it too. But the ability to dream of big factories neither makes it true nor a sound investment. We've heard from some of the pros. Now for the cons. One is never enough. Building, and housing particularly, is a highly localized industry involving large volumes of materials and even larger volumes of built products like houses. Building one central factory close to a major demand center works, but in many cases, the market may not be sufficient to warrant the scale of investment required to make the big factory. The trade-off, of course, is logistics. Transport may be relatively cheap in a high-cost building market, but it ultimately adds little value for the addition of substantial costs and risk. Next, CapEx plus OpEx divided by the amortization period equals delta of savings required. Let me explain. The traditional building industry has been configured and evolved to minimize standing costs, meaning the construction of a new apartment building, for example, begins in earnest after the project has been won, and the people and materials then turn up to site. The big factory idea must compete on day one with the existing building market that has low overheads and very few standing costs. In contrast, the big factory has initial capital expenditure, which is known as CapEx, to buy plant and facilities. It also has operational expenditure, or OpEx, to run the factory and pay the people who work there. Now, unless the big factory was funded through a grant or a gift, both CapEx and OpEx need to be recouped in a given period. This we call the amortization period. This formula can give us an approximate feel for the kinds of savings required to compete with this traditional market. Again, I repeat, CapEx plus OpEx divided by the amortization period equals delta of savings required. If the delta of savings the big factory proposes is not substantial enough, the industry will not be compelled to use the big factory's products and they will remain on the shelf. Next, risk. There are many, many risks in building. Buildings are big, expensive, and very complex human systems. In the conventional industry, margins are razor thin, and a single bad project can severely damage a balance sheet or even sink a company. While the big factory will seek to de-risk many of these contingencies and no doubt be successful in doing so, no matter how successful the big factory is, some stubborn risks will remain, such as capricious local planning requirements, natural disasters, industrial action, global material trade blockages, just to name a few. These risks, operational, financial, economic, regulatory, and environmental in nature, are outside the control of the big factory and its products. From an investment point of view, the big factory idea concentrates and centralizes these risks and their attendant failure points. Next, the cycle. Above, I referred to standing costs and CapEx, OpEx dynamics. There is another insidious aspect of the property market that leaves the big factory highly exposed. As we heard, traditional building has evolved to keep standing costs at a minimum, in order to weather the rise and fall in demand, otherwise known as the cycle. Construction labor forces are flexible in most countries, based on a subcontracting model, where if there is no project, the subcontractor's phone doesn't ring and no money is exchanged. Similarly, owing to the unique nature of most projects, materials are then bought and then brought to site specifically once the project begins, and they are rarely stockpiled. Optimizing for low standing costs in this manner of the traditional building industry creates all kinds of other externalities, but this is an essay for another day. But what it means is that these traditional building companies have levers to pull in the downturn. They do not order the materials, or they do not bring the trades to site. Not the big factory. The big factory is often predicated on a range of production outputs. It can speed up and slow down within a range, but making nothing or slowing to a crawl can be fatal. Next, pipeline and standardization. As a result of all of these factors above, the big factory demands a strong and steady and predictable pipeline of work, something that its proponents will point out upfront. But what is often not taken into account is what products a factory is geared up to produce. In other words, mass production dictates that manufacturing benefits flow when a large quantity of standard products can be made. This is a problem for the big factory because housing is an exercise in diversity, not similarity. No doubt, customizations can be made, but these often involve a cost trade-off, which can further impact the delta of required savings, see above. Now, there are use cases for large numbers of highly standard housing projects, such as manufactured homes or site sheds or remote accommodation camps. But on the most part, houses are stubbornly, how should we say, different. Even houses that might look similar can be markedly different from a manufacturing point of view. Let me illustrate with a point from the auto industry. A production line does not make a small family car and a truck on the same line in the same day. So these are just a few of the points that need to be taken into consideration if we are considering the big factory idea. But does this mean that the big factory is always doomed to fail? No, of course not. In fact, there are great examples worldwide that support the use of the big factory. Together, Sweden and Japan hold many of these. Let me focus on two that I've personally visited multiple times: Lindbäck's Bygg from the north of Sweden and Sekisui House from Japan. Both own big factories that have been broadly successful for a long period of time. A warning, however: cherry-picking these case studies from their respective contexts to bolster the use of the big factory in other countries can leave some important considerations behind. What are these? Well, we can answer that by asking, what do both Sweden and Japan have in common that we should take into account? And what do Lindbäck's and Sekisui House also have in common? Let's start at the national level with Sweden and Japan. Both demonstrate strong manufacturing countries. Both have numerous household names in manufacturing of all kinds of things, from small appliances to heavy machinery. Sweden, a country of just 12 million people, can boast 10 globally known manufacturing companies alone. I don't even need to do the stats for Japan. Both have a strong industrial base. Here I mean Sweden and Japan's ecosystem of suppliers, machinery, or knowledge. In short, this is the capacity and the capability to stand up a factory and run it impeccably. Also, both have time and patience. Both countries are characterized by a solid long-term view of industry and investment, without the kinds of frothy short-termism that can pervade business culture in other parts of the world. And finally, both countries display a strong culture of manufacturing efficiency. Here I mean the culture of continual improvement and efficiency that can be deeply felt when you visit both countries and their companies. Kaizen, as the Japanese refer to it, has become synonymous with Japanese manufacturing. Moving to the companies themselves, Lindbecks and Sekisui House display many of these national attributes. For one, they have taken decades to develop. Sekisui's motto was once slow and smart. This means that investment is made longer term based on known market share and realistic growth expectations. Having the time to build up a strong pipeline and reputation has enabled both companies to progressively invest in their facilities with confidence. Two, their origin stories. While a Japanese corporate and an intergenerational family-owned business from Scandinavia may not at first appear to have much in common, the key similarity is perhaps what they are not. They are not startups, or VC or PE-backed ventures founded on debt, or based on an idea. Rather, they have emerged incrementally over a long time from strong and reputable parent organizations. And finally, both companies have found a niche and stuck to it. Lindbecks works almost exclusively with medium-density housing projects with a clear component of site-by-site customizations. Sekisui House focuses on premium, high-quality detached housing made to order for well-to-do clients. They do both make other things, but they don't use their big factories to do it. By sticking to this market segment over long periods of time, both companies have been able to continually improve their systems, processes, and products in a way that reinforces their competitive advantage and value proposition to the market. These are just some of the conditions that describe how big factories can work. As we can see, not all countries or companies can boast of such qualities or conditions. And, therefore, we need to exercise some caution when we invoke these case studies to compare them with new ventures. Coming back to my colleague and our party, in response to his big factory proposition, my response was as follows. Instead of investing $500 million in one big factory, I said, perhaps we should invest $5 million in 100 factories. Or, even better, only build a factory as an option of last resort. Perhaps we should invest that money into existing facilities, helping them to expand and improve their productivity. But is $5 million enough to build a factory to make houses? He asked. And I said, well, perhaps it would be if they didn't need to be making the whole building, but just parts of it. Going a bit further, I explained that in a market that exhibits a low manufacturing capability, perhaps we could first spend $200 million on figuring out what those factories can make that the rest of the industry could use. That is, the products that go into making houses. And then we could go on to spend the remaining $300 million by sprinkling small grants over the existing industry base to improve their practices and efficiency. He looked suspiciously at me, I would say. So I went on. I said, I know it's not sexy, but the advantages of such an approach would be lower risk, lower capital investment, better resilience in the face of cyclic downturns, more scale and more scalability because there are quite simply many more players over a much broader geographic area. And finally, it'd provide an opportunity to build an ecosystem of small to medium manufacturers creating jobs and a stable sovereign industrial base. Wouldn't that be a good thing? I explained to my colleague that in this scenario, if one company fails, so what? If cyclic downturns come, it's less likely that slowing production on a small to medium-sized manufacturing base will result in catastrophic failures across the board. Also, lower investment in CapEx and OpEx means lower cost structures, which would result in leaner businesses, meaning they would be less subject to the kinds of volatility described above. Stepping out of that conversation at the party again, it's well to explain that the approach I spoke of is not a new business phenomenon. In other sectors, it's referred to as an asset or capital-light approach. Let me provide an example to illustrate this approach in practice. Around a year ago, I visited a factory making bathroom pods. I asked the owner, how many pods were the team making per week? He said they were making 16 now, but at peak demand, their production was double that number. For me, this is a point in case. This company could double its production without requiring a single dollar more of investment. That's the kind of asset and capital-light approach I'm speaking of. Now, where government could help such suppliers is by offering a consistent pipeline of work around a broadly agreed suite of standard products. Furthermore, highly targeted additional funding, incentives, and concessions might be offered to help improve the productivity of this supplier, not by splashing money on big turnkey ventures, but by a targeted sprinkling of smaller, less risky investment on an ecosystem of nascent suppliers and manufacturers. Yes, the coordination work to figure out the products and the standards would need to be done in advance, but in light of all the risks and costs outlined above, the investment required to do this is negligible and could even create a tide that would float all boats. I should declare that the scenario I put to my colleague was not a hypothetical, and I didn't think it up in the moment, as I'd perhaps led him to believe. The group I lead have been working on this problem for some time, hand in hand with our government partners. Think of it as a recipe we've jointly developed to counter many of the pitfalls I've described here, and it sits as a kind of counterpoint to the big factory approach. Moving now to close, you could say that the differences between the big factory idea and this alternative approach could be summarized as follows. One is centralized, the other is decentralized. One concentrates manufacturing, the other distributes manufacturing. One involves only one, and the other the many. One is fixed, and the other is flexible. One involves one large investment, and the other multiple small investments. And one is high risk, and the other is lower risk. So, in summary, does this mean we should never build big factories? No, of course not. Does it mean that this alternative idea I put to my colleague at our party is the only way? No, of course not. But I would be lying if I didn't say that I am deeply worried that current enthusiasms for the big factory idea might just sweep us towards the next Katerra. And more daunting still is the pain and waste, so easy to avoid, that such a collapse would cause. I hope that I've shown that behind the obvious appeal of a big, new, shiny factory that promises to solve all of our problems, that there are not only very many risks, but there may also be other solutions. Solutions that can be better tailored to our needs and which are much, much less risky. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next time.